Despair. Despair is like an invisible pain that you can't explain. I think that's maybe a good way to articulate it. Invisible pain that you can't explain. With despair, it's like something, like a light has gone out inside of you, and you really don't have any hope that it's going to be rekindled somehow. I think that's a good way to think about what despair is, and I'm sure that some of you have been through very difficult, challenging moments of despair. We went around the room and talked about each individual stories. Sure, we have those mountaintop moments, and those are wonderful things at the top, and they're glorious and joyful, but there's also the valley moments. And the valley moments, that's metaphorical language, of course, for challenges, despair, hardships, pain that we experience. And sometimes when you're in that, you're not sure if there's a way out of that valley, and that contributes to this sense of despair. And so maybe you have struggled with some sort of existential despair. Maybe you have, there's been some tragedy in your life, and tragedy is painful and hard and difficult, and that comes in and that somehow eclipses maybe something in the future for us, making us feel despairing. It could be a whole variety of things. William Gurnall, who wrote in the 17th century, said this. He was a keen observer into the human character. He says, despair is unbelief at its full growth. Despair is unbelief at its full growth. And there's a couple of different things here. So unbelief being a seed that grows. And so maybe kind of a first level, you think, okay, I no longer believe because of my despair. I no longer believe because of this event or the situation that help is coming for my job or my relationship or my future, whatever it happens to be. A second level might be a bit more serious. Maybe it is something like, I no longer believe that my life has a greater purpose, and that grows and grows into despair. Maybe the highest level there is, we might say the ultimate level, when we get to such a place where we say there is no one, including no one in heaven, who is here to help me in this impossible situation. And this is despair at its full growth. Now, with Easter, it's great. It's a morning where there's happiness and there's joy. He is risen. He is risen indeed. Absolutely. It's great. And that is appropriate. And that's what it's about. And we will return to that in a second. But sometimes I feel like we jump so quickly to the joy that we forget the place that the disciples were in psychologically, physically, mentally, emotionally, before they discovered that the tomb was empty. Because think about how many things had fallen apart in their lives, okay? So the Messiah comes, they've dedicated their lives 3 years to following Jesus. He's the Messiah. He is the hope of the nation. And so, you know, many of them think that he's going to come and lead this revolt, and they're going to overthrow the dreaded and oppressive Romans, and the nation is finally going to have its independence, and it's going to be glorious like it was 1,000 years ago in the time of King David. It's going to be amazing. Then there's all his teachings, right? Jesus taught about love and forgiveness and righteousness and truth and goodness, all these things, and then Christ died. So does this somehow undercut or dismiss everything that they have come to hold dearly as true? And then there's the fact that he's their friend, okay? So it's not just the teachings. He's not just some objective person out there. They knew him. They walked with him. They talked with him. They got to know him so intimately, so closely, and he's dead, and he died a horrific death. And then the fact that they abandon him. So everyone except John flees, not to mention Judas. People leave in his darkest hour. Now he has died this horrific death, this Christ, and they know that they have abandoned him. All of this is in the setting to this, and he's died. And so thinking of Gurnall's definition, despair is unbelief at its full growth. Maybe they no longer have any belief in the nation. Maybe they no longer believe in the teachings of Jesus because he is dead, and maybe all of that, you know, was for naught. Or maybe they have stopped believing in themselves because they were with him and they left him. And so all of this kind of sums up the setting before that sunrise on the first Easter morning. And the question is there help and hope when things seem impossible? Is there help and hope when things seem impossible? And it's a question for them then, but also for us now. So we're going to open our Bibles to Mark chapter 16, and this is a part of our series through the Gospel of Mark. So those of you who have been tracking along over the past several months, we've been going through the chapters line by line, verse by verse, and we are now at chapter 16 towards the end of the story. And this is after, of course, the pain, the trial, the torture, and the crucifixion itself. So let's pick it up, chapter 16, verse 1, reading from the ESV. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And so there's three women who are named. They've bought spices. And so this would have been an act of reverence. It was customary. And it's an act of devotion. And so it actually would have been a financial sacrifice for them to purchase the amount of spices that they would have needed. But they're going there. And whenever you see people named, if they've been named as a group somewhere earlier in the story, you realize, okay, I should note something about what happened before, because that might give us insight into their state of mind now. And these three women are named very specifically in chapter 15, verse 40. Why? They were at the cross. And so they were there seeing the crucifixion of Christ. Think of that for a second. So they've seen it. This is just some objective thing. They've seen Jesus. He's gone through this mock trial. He's been tortured. He's been flayed and whipped. So it's an ancient form of torture where much of the skin is pulled from the body. The crown of thorns, the thorns are thrust deeply into his head so that the blood flows. The spikes in the hands and the feet, the blood on the side. It's just a horrific scene. You can't unsee that. Back in 2015, many of us were affected profoundly by a picture that you can't unsee. There was a little boy, 2 years old, and he was on the shore, and he was passed away, a young Syrian boy, Alan Kurdi, fleeing from Syria, trying to find a home with his family somewhere else. You can't unsee a picture like that. And these women at the cross, they were physically there, and it wasn't a stranger. They actually knew him. And so they, knowing the situation into which they were walking, were seeking to anoint him. Verse 2, and very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb, and they were saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb? Good question, right? So we don't have these practices as much anymore, so these customs seem unfamiliar, but a stone that would have been in front of the tomb was between like 1.5 and 2 tons. So it's massive. It's very big. So would have weighed more than most small cars, right? So they're asking practical questions. Verse 4, and looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. Okay, so they're alarmed. So not only has the stone been moved away, but it is a very serious offense to tamper with a dead body or a tomb. This is actually called the Nazareth inscription, an archaeological discovery from the time of Christ. And it is actually an edict from Caesar himself saying that if you tamper with the tomb or if you tamper with a dead body, it could be capital punishment. So this is very serious stuff. So this didn't happen. And people were, so they're startled. Someone's here. Not only is the stone rolled away, but someone is in this very dangerous, precarious situation sitting in the tomb. And it's a man. Now, he has white clothes, as we read from some of the other accounts. Matthew 28 says it's an angel. Okay, next verse, verse 6. And he said to them, do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Now, okay, so they're in shock, right? Because Jesus isn't here, and this messenger, this angel, has proclaimed that he is, in fact, risen. Now, it's a shock to them, but we as readers have kind of been anticipating this for a while. Not only do we know the story, but if we're tracking along very carefully, back in chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus said that he would be crucified and killed, and he would rise on the third day. And so in Jewish reckoning of time, a portion of a day was a day. So Friday is day 1, Saturday is day 2, Sunday is day 3. So we're kind of anticipating it and waiting for it, but this would have been a surprise to the women. And they didn't expect resurrection. So sometimes we think, okay, the Jews generally were like thinking people are resurrected all the time. Not so. So many of the ancient Jews thought that there was going to be a general resurrection at the end of time, but the fact that someone would be resurrected before the end of human history was novel. No one was expecting that. So that is a big deal. Now, before we move on, I want to say one or two quick words for the skeptics among us. And over time, many people have tried to say various things to kind of explain away the resurrection, the physical, actual resurrection of Christ, which historic Christianity, biblical Christianity affirms. So I'm not going to get into all that today, but I will say that on the church's website, under the event for this service, and also on my own website, there's actually a document I've put together, the 7 most frequent conspiracy theories against the resurrection and responses to those. And so I direct you to those to check them out. The other thing I'll say before we move on is that sometimes I think as modern people, we look back on ancient peoples and we think they're idiots. We have this modern snobbery. I think C.S. Lewis called it chronological snobbery. We think that because we're modern people, everyone else before us was really dumb. But that's not true. People in the ancient world, it would have been a miracle to them just as it is a miracle to us. They would have been shocked and surprised. They had real experiences. They had more hardship than us, more trials than us, earlier death, more sickness and disease than us. And so it's naive of us to think that they are all gullible. Like, this is a miracle no matter what era you are in. And I would argue that if they were to look at us in our modern digital time, well, let me just say it like this. How many of you have seen a political meme posted over the past week or two, which is so radically simplistic, regardless of the party, it's so radically simplistic that someone doing at least 30 seconds of research could tell that it was untrue? All the time. Hopefully it wasn't you. Probably somebody you know, but maybe not you, probably not you. But this kind of simplistic gullibility is all over the place. And so I think they could look at us and also wag their finger a little bit. So we need to be careful about having this chronological snobbery to us. But they're amazed. Oh my goodness, what's going on? Okay, chapter 16, verse 7. But go tell his disciples, the messenger says, and Peter, that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. Okay, we've been tracking through the story. In chapter 14, Jesus said this very thing. They're going to Galilee, which is his headquarters in the north. Verse 8, and they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And that's it. And the resurrection account, it stops right there. Now, more is going to happen, of course. There's a lot more in the New Testament, and Jesus is going to go on. He's going to personally appear to them. He's going to appear over a course of weeks and weeks. He's going to appear to hundreds and hundreds of people, as I read earlier from 1 Corinthians 15. But Mark is very short. So if you want a lot of other the details about the various conversations that were had and what Jesus did next, you have to look other places. And in fact, it's really interesting when you look at how much each of the four Gospels dedicates to the resurrection story. So I put a little graph together. The number of verses about the resurrection, Matthew has 20, Mark has 8, which we just read, Luke has 53, and John has 56. Now, it's interesting, why is that? I actually think it's on purpose. Now, we know that Mark's gospel, these are the stories and sayings of the apostle Peter, and he's given them to Mark, and Mark has written them down. So these are, you know, this is from someone who is walking with and talking with Jesus. And it's the shortest of the Gospels. It's a need-to-know basis. It's all the shortest information, the shortest accounts, generally speaking. And then why is it so short at the end? Well, I think it's on purpose because if the women go out and they don't say anything to anybody, clearly that was their immediate response. They would have had to say something to someone eventually or else we wouldn't have the story. And so initially they were afraid and terrified. And so it leaves us with a sense, okay, what are they going to do with the knowledge about the resurrection? And therefore, since we're reading it, what are we going to do with the knowledge of the resurrection? Are we just going to keep it to ourselves, or are we going to somehow let it impact our lives? So we end our close look at the text there. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Is there hope or help when things seem impossible then and now? Tony Campolo tells a story about the movie The Seventh Seal when it came out. This is the movie poster to it. The Seventh Seal, there's a dark figure on the right side with a chess piece. Came out in 1957, and basically as it goes through this movie, there is this medieval knight, and this medieval knight is playing this cosmic game of chess with the Prince of Darkness, with death himself, okay? Medieval knight praying, and as they go through the movie, you know, the medieval knight makes a move, and then the Prince of Darkness, death himself, makes a move, goes back and forth, and it's building and building as the movie goes forward. Finally, you can sense a climax coming, and finally, the Prince of Darkness makes one final move against the king and says, checkmate, and the curtain falls, and the movie ends. That's it. That's strange. The movie's over. And you think, okay, well, maybe death wins sometimes. Maybe the Prince of Darkness does win sometimes. That seems to be the point. Now, as Campolo tells it, there's actually someone sitting in the theater watching the movie when it comes out, and it's none other than Bobby Fischer. And Bobby Fischer was an expert chess player. So the very next year, Bobby Fischer actually becomes the world chess grand champion. So he knows what he's doing with the chessboard. So he's watching this movie with great interest, of course, because it's like going back and forth, and he knows the game of chess. He knows the possible moves. And so as he's watching the movie in this final scene, the Prince of Darkness makes this move, checkmate, the movie ends. And apparently, Fisher becomes puzzled, and he leans over to his friend who was there watching the movie with and says, "Why is he giving up? The king has one more move. The king has one more move. The king has one magnificent move that can turn the tide and win the game." Because he's the actual chess expert. And he's sitting there, and it's like, he knows more about chess than the Prince of Darkness. He knows more about chess than the writers and producers of the movie. And Campolo goes on to explain that this is a central part of the message of Easter. The king has one more move. Death grimaces, death struts on Saturday with a certain cockiness, but the king has one more move, even though the Prince of Darkness thinks he has won. And this isn't something that just comes up at the empty tomb. Now, the biggest example of this, of course, is the empty tomb. It's the triumph over sin, death, darkness, Satan himself, right? But we've been seeing evidences all through the gospel story. Let me give you a couple examples. Way back to chapter 1, and we've studied this. Chapter 1, verse 40, the leper, he's cast out. He's ritually unclean. He's abandoned. He actually has to yell, "Unclean, unclean," as people approach so that they might not be contaminated by him. He's out of options, and to him, the Prince of Darkness comes up and whispers, "Checkmate." Not so. Jesus comes, and with the word, he is cured. The king had one more move. Chapter 2, verse 3, a paralyzed man, questioned, challenged, he's lost in sin, he's out of work in his life, he is seemingly out of options, and to him, the Prince of Darkness comes up and whispers, "Checkmate." Not so. Jesus comes up, and with the word, healing, the king had one more move. Fast forward a bit, chapter 2, verse 14. There's the tax collector, Levi, hated by his family, most likely hated by the nation. He's an outcast. He's alone. He is out of options. And to him, the Prince of Darkness comes up and says, "Checkmate." Not so. Jesus comes and says, "Follow me." The king had one more move. Chapter 4, verse 37, disciples, they're in peril in the boat, in the storm. Fear, terror, death, they are out of options. To them, the Prince of Darkness whispers, "Checkmate." Jesus awakens, "Be still." The king had one more move. Fast forward, chapter 5, verse 2, a man with a legion of demons, tortured, outcast, in pain, out of options. To him, the Prince of Darkness whispers from within, "Checkmate." And Jesus says, "Not so. Be gone." The king had one more move. Chapter 5, verse 25, a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. No one could help. She was alone. She was suffering. She was cast out. She was pure. The text said that she had spent all her money on physicians. No one could help. To her, the Prince of Darkness comes up and whispers, "Checkmate." Not so. To her, Jesus approaches. She touches the fringe of his garment. He heals her with the word. The king had one more move. And this happens on and on through the Gospels. The king had one more move, and the same is true today. And part of the challenge for us as Christians today is we need to go from past tense to present tense. Because not only did the king have one more move, the king has one more move. He has it, present tense. And so this isn't just something that happened, it is something that happens. And what we need to think about is, okay, when we think about the impossible situations that we are in, do we worship a corpse-raising God or not? Do we believe that this power is actually possible in our own lives, or has despair grown to the point of unbelief, or we're just not sure anymore? And if you're unsure, I want to introduce you to George Dennehy. He was born in Romania. George was born without arms, okay? He's born without arms, and because of all the stigma of that in his part of the world, he was abandoned. And he's abandoned, and he just so happened to make out to an orphanage in Romania that he describes as grim. Out of options, checkmate. So what happens? An urgent plea goes out. He was 18 months old, and he was adopted at this point by a loving family in America. And because of the love that they had and surrounded him, he actually learned a variety of instruments, including the guitar. He's got no arms. Including the guitar. In the video portion I'm about to show you, he is playing a song he wrote. Remember how he was abandoned? He's playing in a church to the glory of God. The song is called "Not Abandoned."
Your door, fire, all is broken, there is a pathway.
How awesome is that? George Denhe, Not Abandoned. I'll put the link on the website and we'll share it on social media this afternoon. Not Abandoned, the place where the devil whispers, checkmate. The Lord comes along and says, no. One more move. And so what is your supposed checkmate? What is that thing in your life that you think is an impossible situation where the devil, you think, is supposedly whispering checkmate, but the king comes along and says, no, one more move. What is that supposed checkmate? Maybe for you it's a relationship. There's some sort of relationship that you think that's it, it's done. I'm out of options, and you feel as if the prince of darkness himself is whispering into that relationship, checkmate. No, the king has one more move. What is your supposed checkmate? Maybe it's some sort of shame in your past. There's something shameful in your life and shame in your past, and you've got to the point where you've been in that valley so long, you think that's actually the ultimate thing that defines you. Not so. The king always has one more move. That supposed checkmate, maybe it is some mistake that you've made, and you think because of that mistake, and the prince of darkness comes along and says, you fool, checkmate. Not so. The king has one more move. Maybe it's some sort of plan for the future and things are not working out. You're like, it's not happening. There's too many barriers, and you feel like the prince of darkness has come along and whispered, checkmate. Not so. Maybe it's some sort of illness which has changed things, and it's painful, and it's hard, and you think because of that, that better is not possible. Not so. The king has one more move. Maybe it's some sort of powerful fear in your life, and you feel the prince of darkness has come up and whispered, checkmate, but don't let that fear govern you, because we worship a corpse-raising God who has one more move always. And so our question, is there help and hope when things seem impossible? Well, if Jesus is dead, the answer is no. But because Jesus is alive, the answer is always yes. The answer is yes. Is help and hope possible when things are as challenging as they are? If Jesus is dead, the answer is no. But because he is alive, the answer is yes. And friends, let me tell you, when the world whispers to you, checkmate, our God says, not so fast. The king has one more move. Praise be to our resurrected Redeemer.